Welcome to ELT's Summer Survival Series.
It's officially summer in certain hemispheres, so we're bringing back some of our favorite ELT episodes to help you celebrate slash survive. Today's show, how baseball and organ music became an item. After this episode, you'll be able to drop some organ knowledge at your next baseball game and some baseball knowledge at your next organ recital.
Hi, guys. This is Robert Chapman from Clinton, Mississippi. The question is, the organ. Did somebody just say, hey, let's take an organ out of church and play it at a baseball game? How did that start?
Hello.
Hi, Robert. It's Flora from ELT. How are you?
I'm doing great here in Mississippi.
Should we start with a cheer?
We can, yeah.
I say organ, you say?
Yay? I don't know. How does this? I don't know.
Organ?
Yay.
Organ.
Yay.
Why did you call about this? Why do you care about organs?
Well, it's not necessarily that I care about organs. It's just I've spent a lot of time growing up with my father and my mother taking me and my brother to baseball games. And you always hear, you know, the da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da, clap, clap. And then, you know, you have da-da-da-da-da-da. You know, chicken dances, things like that. It's very Americana. I've always wondered, why an organ?
Well, why not an organ?
Because it's a reverent sound, like Notre Dame type of music where the monks are chanting with it. And then, of course, you know, down here in the Southeast, the organ is always played at church.
You're saying the organ is not the perfect match for nachos, fly balls.
Yes.
Touchdowns. Robert, I'm not a big baseball person. If baseball was on Tinder, do you think it would swipe right on organ?
I don't know. I mean, it would almost be like, does baseball have another option? Like, is baseball trying to find a soulmate, or is baseball having to fit the expectation of what mom and dad placed before?
You mean like it's an awkward arranged marriage for baseball?
Absolutely.
Well, what do you think? What instrument do you think would be a better match for baseball?
I don't know. You can't do a trumpet.
What about tuba?
Tuba would be good to make fun of people who can't catch a fly ball.
Alp horn? You know, that like Ricola horn?
Absolutely. That would be fantastic. Oh, that would be, you should call the Colorado Rockies and see if they want to put that in their stadium, because that would very much fit their milieu.
Well, what's your theory about how organs got to baseball stadiums?
I don't know. I told a friend of mine one time that I think maybe they built a baseball stadium around an organ, realized how heavy it was, and said, let's just go with it.
Okay, Robert, you wanted to know, how did the organ become the peanut butter to baseball's jelly?
Yes.
The first person we drafted to answer your question is an organist and organ historian.
My name is Stephen Ball.
As in, play ball.
Da-da-da-da-da-da!
I'm the director of music at the Oratory of St. Francis de Sales in St. Louis, Missouri.
Are you wearing a tuxedo right now?
I am not wearing a tuxedo. I am wearing cowboy boots and blue jeans. In fact, my favorite organ shoes are my cowboy boots.
Robert, what do you think came first, the baseball or the organ?
I'd have to say maybe the organ.
Slam dunk. The organ was invented over 2,000 years ago.
Oh, wow.
We think that an ancient Greek barber by the name of Ctesibius invented this thing.
So it starts out in ancient Greece and Rome. Robert, you want to guess where they were using it?
Maybe inside wooden horses?
To keep themselves occupied when when they were invading.
Right, they got, you know, they didn't have Netflix. It's not like they had DVD systems.
Mr. Ball said, think more along the lines of baseball.
The organ was first used in the arena to accompany anything that was going on there.
But arena sports at the time were a little different than they are today.
Chariot races, gladiator games.
Instead of balls rolling, it's like heads rolling.
Higher stakes.
All of those things are things that I think you could expect to have an organ present at.
Do you think that they were used like they are in baseball games? Like, na-na-na-na, you know, when someone is killed?
Crowd support, you betcha.
Robert, is this changing your view of the organ at all?
It is. It you know, I always associate the organ with a place of worship, but instead you've told me that it has started in a place of torture and death. Which, if some people would argue, are one and the same. I'm just going to put that out there.
Okay, let's fast forward about 1,000 years to medieval times.
Okay.
The era, not the fantastic dinner theater.
Of course.
At this point, the organ goes from taking lives to saving lives. It now goes to church.
The organ gets saved.
And it's a good fit because the organ can sound holy and hopeful or evoke hellfire and brimstone. On the other hand, it's never been the most practical instrument, especially back then.
Playing the organ up until modern times was always a team sport because you needed so many people to actually make these machines go.
It took a bunch of people to play the organ because it's basically a giant wind instrument. You press a key, air goes through a pipe, and that's what makes the sound.
Yeah.
And that air needs to come from somewhere. In the 12th century, that meant a dozen people pumping blacksmith's bellows with their feet.
If you can imagine, maybe about 20 of these on the floor. So you'd have a left foot in one and your right foot in the other. It's like the Stairmaster of the 12th century. You know, if you can imagine getting your cardio in that way.
It took a village to play na 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 hey hey, you're going to hell.
I always tell people that's probably why Bach had 20-something children, is because he needed somebody to pump the bellows all the time.
Robert, let's fast forward 1,000 years. It's the early 1900s. We have electricity to do the work of children. And the organ is enlisted for a different form of weekend entertainment.
Let's see. Early 1900s, weekend entertainment. Would it, by chance, have anything to do with a speakeasy?
Strike one.
I see what you did there. Boating?
Strike two.
I don't know. I'm going to take this pitch, and it's going right down the middle. Strike out. I don't know. Movie theaters, yes.
To accompany silent films.
The theater organ as we know it essentially was introduced into motion picture theaters probably around 1910.
Movies quickly became America's other national pastime. By some estimates, half the American population was going to the movies every week by the 1920s. The theaters got bigger, and they needed an instrument that was up for the job.
And so once you get past like 300 seats, it's really hard to pound on a piano hard enough to get heard all the way to the back rows of the theater. And so organs were sort of a natural solution because they could fill the entire theater.
By the 1930s, the organ was associated with entertainment, which helps explain its transition to baseball.
Okay.
Okay, to cover this next base, we needed someone deep in the baseball organ world.
Some people just know at a very young age, like, I want to be a firefighter, I want to be a lawyer, I want to be
a... I want to be a baseball organist.
Yeah.
No, this is Josh Cantor. He plays the organ at Fenway Park in Boston.
All through growing up, baseball and music were the two things that I was most passionate about. So yeah, I guess in that regard, you know, I sort of made a Venn diagram and there was this little sliver in the middle that was like playing the organ at baseball games.
Josh got the job by auditioning. He said it was a little harrowing because the interviewer was running late.
He said, I'm stuck in this meeting, but the conference room that I'm in has a window that faces out to the ballpark. So I'm going to open the window and just ask the audio engineer to feed the organ through all the speakers in the ballpark. So my first audition was basically for the whole Fenway neighborhood and an empty stadium. And that was a little intimidating.
Yeah. If Boston loves you, it's great. If Boston hates you, you know for a fact.
They loved him. Josh got the job, and he's been playing for the last 16 years.
Welcome back to SportsCenter. There's Josh Cantor, the Red Sox organist, serenading us all day, getting us in the mood for baseball.
That's cool. That really is.
Robert, Josh had an answer to your question about when organs went to baseball stadiums.
It's a good question. The first time it happened was in 1941 at Wrigley Field, longtime home of the Chicago Cubs.
So Wrigley Field tried the organ as an experiment.
Why not, right?
Yeah, people were used to the organ from movie theaters, and there had been music at games already.
There were bands that played at baseball games prior to the organ music. They were typically like pep bands that might be just sort of a horn section of fans that sat in the stands and would learn songs and then would play them.
But with the organ, you got a lot of bang for your buck. You could get this whole orchestra sound with just one person.
So it was probably cheaper, more effective, more practical than hiring a band.
Yeah.
So that's how the organ got its start in baseball. Then from Wrigley Field, it spread to other diamonds. They went to the Brooklyn Dodgers in 1942, and they hired a local organist who became a legend.
Hello, this is Gladys Gooding. For the past several years, I have been playing in Ebbets Field for our beloved bums, the Brooklyn Dodgers.
Gladys Gooding. She was greatly beloved, and she would compose original fight songs for the team. And people would sing along.
So Gladys's job was to rev up the crowd between innings. To get people amped, she would play the Billboard Hot 100 of the day. Are you feeling pumped?
I am.
You know, this was before the days of rock and roll, so you're talking about, you know, the on the charts would have been, like, probably a lot of Bing Crosby, show tunes.
Those are the kind of certified bangers baseball organists kept playing and playing and playing and playing for the next 30 years.
It does not evolve with the times.
Robert, you wanted to know how organs got to baseball stadiums.
Yes.
But you might ask, how did they stay there? Because by the 70s, the organ was falling out of favor. The country was climbing the stairway to heaven while the organ was stuck in Tin Pan Alley.
You know, the organ was in danger of becoming irrelevant.
I was thinking, like, it's the bottom of the ninth and the home team is down a few goals.
Or runs.
That's the situation the organ is in. But then a slugger steps up to the tiny white square and changes the game forever.
Nancy Faust, Chicago White Sox organist, that was the seismic shift. It really was not until Nancy came along in 1970 at the age of 23 and updated the repertoire and was young and hip, and all of a sudden, huge swaths of young fans were like, this is cool, this is great.
Nancy Faust perfected the organ's role at baseball games. She used it for commentary, for jokes, for razzing opposing players. Josh has a word for this.
Crimsical, the line that divides whimsical from cruel. If you can land right on crimsical, that's the perfect spot.
And Nancy could. She came onto the baseball organ scene and left it all shook up.
It's the same way that the popular music landscape was not the same after Elvis appeared, is what Nancy did to this much smaller, much more niche genre of live baseball organ music.
Nancy Faust is the Elvis of baseball organ music.
Yeah, you could say that she's the Elvis.
And good news, Robert, this Elvis is also still alive. And we're going to meet her after the break.
For a walk, I would do this.
Do you need a seventh inning stretch?
Absolutely.
What should we do?
We always get a beer.
I mean, it's 11:07 a.m. here. Okay, Nancy, we're rolling.
Every time you say a word, I think of a song. I swear to God. Rolling, rolling, rolling. Roll with it, baby.
Robert, you are listening to the one and only Nancy Faust, the person who changed the game of baseball organ playing. She was the White Sox organist for 41 seasons. That's more than 3,000 matches.
They're games.
So I asked Nancy if she'd play for us.
Yes.
And within 1 second of sitting down, Nancy's 41 years of live scoring experience became apparent. Let me give you an example. Nancy's sister happened to be in the room helping with the recording.
And because it's my sister. Well, that my earpiece fell out, but that was All in the Family, wasn't it?
I think
so. And because
so,
you're
yes.
my sister, I played that for you, Judy.
Oh, okay.
So Nancy retired in 2010. Now she lives outside of Phoenix. And because the organ is too big for her house, she keeps it in the barn.
We kind of reconfigured the tack room, and now it's a soundproof music room. I could listen, my donkey. Donkey.
Are there donkeys nearby?
Oh, they're across the aisle. Mm-hmm. I can play them a little donkey serenade or On the Trail or Mr. Ed or something like that.
How did you become a donkey owner?
In the late 70s, when Bill Veeck took over the White Sox, he was well known for promotions. And one of his promotions involved a door prize. But this one particular night, it was called Ragtime Night, and one of the door prizes was a donkey, a swayback donkey.
A living donkey.
A real donkey.
What a terrible door prize.
You're so right. I don't know. We did things differently in those days. I wouldn't advocate that now. I wouldn't even give somebody a fish unless I was sure they could care for it in a big tank. But regardless, nobody claimed it, and he was going to return it to Adventureland, which was a kiddie park that had donated it. And I said, no, don't return it. I'd like to have it. So he let me have it. So that's when the magic began between me and donkeys.
But Robert, we're not here for that kind of magic. We're here to listen to Nancy work her magic with another loud noisemaker in her barn.
Yes.
So I pitched Nancy some scenarios and asked her what song she'd pick for each one.
Okay.
Okay, what about this? Manager runs out of the dugout.
Okay, so the manager walks out to the dugout, and as he's walking, I'm keeping up with the steps. And he goes a little faster. And then he has a conference with the pitcher. I might play. What song that is?
What is it?
That was Jive Talkin'. Or let's say the manager comes out this time and we know he's going to take the pitcher out. So as he approaches the pitcher, he walks out of the dugout. I'd be doing this. That would be Jaws. And then as he walks away, everybody would sing so long to the pitcher. That would be Nana Goodbye.
Nana Goodbye is one of Nancy's signatures.
It's so great because, you know, here in the South, we always say that you can say anything you want about anybody as long as you say, bless their heart. I cannot believe she got her hair cut like that, bless her heart. And it's almost like that's her organ talking of, oh, the pitcher's about to be taken out, bless his heart.
I love that. I'm going to start incorporating that. Listen for it, Robert, on ELT.
I shall. I certainly shall.
So, Robert, you're listening to peak Nancy. But it would take her a minute to find her organ legs. During her rookie season, she was a side note at best.
The role was just to provide some nice Muzak elevator-type music in between innings.
She was parked way in the center field bleachers, and the fans weren't psyched about her either.
A few days after I started, there was a petition being circulated that a woman doesn't belong in my position. And I thought, oh my God, there goes my job, you know.
A petition against you.
Yes. And I didn't feel confident to stick up for myself or anything to say, hey, this is crazy. I'm just as good as anybody. So I just fretted about it. But that didn't last long. It blew over.
Her second year behind the pipes, things started to change. She earned a big fan with a big megaphone.
My second year is when our flamboyant broadcaster joined the Sox. That was Harry Carey.
Hey. Hi, everybody. Harry Carey here.
This is my gift to late 90s SNL fans.
I suddenly want a hot dog for some reason.
First, I'd smother myself with brown mustard and relish. I'd be so delicious.
Anyway, the real Harry quickly noticed Nancy.
The first time I was ever recognized was when I listened to Harry do his broadcast, and he mentioned something about, oh, this game's putting me to sleep. The Sox better wake up or they're going to have to carry me out of here. And I heard him say that, and so I did a few bars of Carry Me Back to Old Virginia. Well, he heard me, and he said, well, listen to that. Listen to the organist. Even the organist agrees with me. And that kind of put me on the map with him.
Okay, Nancy.
And by her third year, Nancy was so popular that the head of the White Sox relocated her from the bleachers to the best seat in the house.
I was brought directly behind home plate. 10 box seats were removed, and they placed the organ there.
That's a lot of revenue, too, so that showed their devotion.
Yeah, and one of the reasons why people were devoted is that Nancy invented something as important to the game as Cracker Jacks and long bathroom lines. Walk-up music.
Oh, wow.
You know, the music that is played when a batsman takes the plate. Are you familiar with this?
Oh, yeah. I helped coach some high school baseball, and as a teacher, I have not seen anyone put more thought into a brainstorming session than a shortstop trying to find out what their walkout song will be.
Nancy took a different approach. For her, these were split-second calls.
Why would I play White or Shade of Pale? Well, the ball player's last name was White. Or I might have played White Rabbit. Or I'm Dreaming of a White Christmas. Or Paloma Blanca, because his last name was White. So it was a stretch. Or a number, somebody's number, you know, a player's number was 1. You play 1 is the loneliest number. 19th nervous breakdown for number 19. Or the Magnificent 7, the theme from My Three Sons many years ago. Or
Robert, Nancy could and did go on for 5 minutes straight.
Oh, I have no doubt.
So, I mean, just there was always an association that I could think of a song. And still today, when I hear songs where if I'm shopping or something, I think, oh, why didn't I think of that? That would have been great for this or that.
Besides walk-up music, Nancy started playing anytime there was an opening in the game, anytime something happened that needed punctuation.
If a streaker ran out to the field, I'd play Is That All There Is. If the lights went out, I'd play Dim All the Lights. The manager walks out to the mound. He's going to take a pitcher out. I'd play my Bohemian Rhapsody. Oh, please don't let me go. No, you know, remember, well, we all know Bohemian Rhapsody now. And it was just another dimension of ballpark entertainment. Songs that I selected became riddles for fans.
She's like the crossword puzzle of the baseball stadium.
Yes.
One funny one is I remember George Brett, I was told by a fan, do you know he's returning, he just had hemorrhoid surgery. So I played You Can't Sit Down. And then when he came up next time, I played Walk Right In, Set Right Down, just things like that, or Hurt So Good or Hurt So Bad, you know, I mean, little things like that that I was able to learn from the fans.
Nancy, hearing you talk, it's like you have an encyclopedia of songs, but also you can make these connections so fast.
Oh, thank you. Life in the Fast Lane. I don't know. That's just the way I think. And even after retirement, my husband and I both, we hear a phrase on TV and then we'll sing something that had that phrase in it or that just one word. That's in my genes now because it's the way I've lived my whole life is just how can you apply a song? But it's the result of many hours and many years of honing my skills.
Nancy made modern baseball music what it is today. She went from being an interloper to an institution. When an owner threatened to move her out of the box seats, fans came to her defense.
The fans that used to sit around the organ, they circulated a petition, and they presented it to Mr. Vec, and he, sure enough, the next homestand, he had me back, you know, back in the upper deck, almost in the same place.
They petitioned to bring you back.
Yes, even though I took up box seats. It was a feature that had become embraced. And looking back, it was quite a charmed life.
Today, we honor the special member and fan favorite of the White Sox family, Nancy Faust, and wish her a fond farewell as organist for the Chicago White Sox.
Thank you. I think we should put Nancy on the ELT Bulletin Board of Glory.
Oh, yeah.
This is our place to celebrate innovators who have made life a little better for a lot of people.
I think that's a good idea.
What walk-up music would we play for? Should we play for Nancy?
Oh, let's see. See, I wish I had her skill of immediately pulling something out of the air.
I know. We need Nancy to tell us.
We do. Nancy, please tell me the answer to this question. Oh, you know what? Exactly what we could do. She knows every little thing. Maybe she does the Police's every little thing she does is magic.
We have Nancy playing that. You want to hear it?
No way. Yes, I do.
Robert.
Yes.
Great question. Bless your heart.
Touche.
We are always looking for nominations for the ELT Bulletin Board of Glory. Previous honorees have included the person behind the gas tank arrow, the one that tells you which side to fill up on, and the engineer who figured out how to make a cinching trash bag. Is there an innovator you think should be recognized? Give us a call and we'll track them down. 833-RING-ELT or email us at gimletmedia.com, subject line BBOG.
Every Little Thing is produced by Aaron Reese, Phoebe Flanagan, Annette Heist, and Flora Lichtman, with help from Nicole Pasulka and Doug Barron. Our consulting editors are Caitlin Kenny and Jorge Just. Mixed by Dara Hirsch. Scored by Dara Hirsch and Dan Brunel. ELT Summer Survival theme song by Bobby Lord. Na 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 na. Na 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 na. Hey hey hey. Goodbye. Goodbye.